Hello and welcome to Saber, a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and today we're talking about cocktail bitters.
Indeed. Something I am fairly new to.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I guess when I started getting into making cocktails, maybe about 7 or 8 years ago, I got pretty into bitters. I went from like, what is this product, to I need 7 flavors in my home cabinet very quickly.
Right.
I've calmed down a little bit since then, but yeah.
It is exciting when you discover them and you discover there's so many flavors.
Oh, yeah.
The whole world.
Well, we are living in this beautiful bitters renaissance.
We are indeed.
I mean, I've always been living in a bitter renaissance, but...
I wasn't going to say anything.
Thank you, by the way, to listener Kat for suggesting this topic. Specifically, she had found an article about using bitters in recipes and sent it along. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
Good suggestion.
Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And still, one of my favorite videos we ever made back when we did videos it was like 8 a.m. on a Tuesday when we filmed this. And we trekked downstairs to the market portion of our office to 1821 Bitters.
Which is a company that makes bitters and other things, sure.
To film a video on cocktails, specifically the gin and tonic and the tonic part of the gin and tonic, because they also make their own tonic.
Right.
And so she made, the lovely person made gin and tonics for us and whiskey sours, and we were drinking them at like 8, 9 in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
And then we had a meeting.
You had a meeting. I had nothing. I had nothing to do. But yeah, you certainly were like, welp, straight to my meeting.
Thanks for the drinks. And I got one of my favorite t-shirts out of it, which is it's a picture of a woman crying with a cocktail that says, ask me why I'm bitter.
It is an excellent shirt.
It is.
Yes. Every time I wear it, I get someone, like some stranger out in the world who like reads it and then just bursts out laughing.
Yes, which is a wonderful response to a t-shirt for sure. But all of this brings us to our question, cocktail bitters. What are they?
Well, bitters are highly concentrated preparations of herbs, spices, and other plant stuff that's been extracted in some kind of neutral flavor base, usually alcohol or glycerin. And you can put anything you want in there, really. The end result does not even have to taste bitter, although they often do.
Mm-hmm.
The 4 main categories that have classically been around have been aromatic, meaning spice and bark notes dominate; New Orleans style, meaning anise notes dominate; citrus, I think you can figure that one out; and celery, meaning celery seed dominates. You might modernly add categories like a chocolate, fruit, spicy, as in like spicy hot, not spicy spiced, and spiced, meaning spices like cloves might dominate. Sometimes these are also called tiki style bitters.
We never completed our Spice Girls pun with the spices. Oh, I got to put that back on the top of my to-do list.
All right. Well, it's there now.
Yes.
Goodness.
Very exciting.
Annie's eyes just lit up right now. Oh. You guys. Plans.
So many.
Okay. But the result of all of this, back to bitters, is it can vary pretty widely, but it often tastes, yes, bitter and herbal and citrusy and earthy and woody and spiced.
Mm-hmm.
They can be consumed straight, sipped or as a shot, but are more commonly used like a few drops at a time in a larger drink, commonly to add complexity to cocktails or to flavor sodas or wines.
Yeah, I love the kind of like extreme caution when you buy bitters. They're like, you only need 1 or 2 drops to do the job. Like, don't overdo it.
It would be the worst.
For Pete's sake. And so I've never done anything other than like a couple drops, and I'm always kind of nervous. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Oh, I do really heady splashes.
Do you?
I mean, as we have discussed before, bitter is my favorite flavor.
Right.
And I'll put them in anything. Like if I have a wine that I think is too sweet, like especially a white wine or a sparkle, like I'll just throw like 6 dashes of bitters in there.
Giving me some ideas, Lauren.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll live on the wild side.
And they don't have to be restricted to beverage use. You can put them in anything else you want. There's all sorts of recipes and suggestions out there for everything from bitter-infused fruit salads to ice creams to baked goods to soups to marinades. It's
so
a flavor.
It is a flavor.
Uh-huh.
Well, what about the nutrition of this flavor?
Well, I mean, it's when they're made with alcohol, they're usually around 90 proof. So drink responsibly, as you would with anything. It's, you know, not a calorie-free food, but it is a very strong flavor for the amount that you're probably using.
Yeah.
Yeah. And bitters got their start and have long been lauded even up into modern times as a medicinal thing, like a digestive aid. And some research has shown that some bitter plants like wormwood and gentian, which are often used as ingredients in bitters, can indeed facilitate digestion by increasing the heart rate and blood pressure, which creates more blood flow to the organs that need to do that work of digestion, and also by stimulating the production of gastric juices in your stomach. However, the amount that you'd need to take for those things to work is in, like, supplement territory, so probably not what you'd get from using a few drops or even a shot of bitters, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But if you like doing it, I'm not going to tell you not to.
Yeah. We don't have that much power.
we really
yet.
Have. Ooh. I like that.
I thought. Anyway, as we've mentioned, there are all kinds of bitters. At this year's Atlanta Food and Wine, I tried, they had like a lineup, and I tried a coffee one, a chocolate one, a pecan one, a ghost pepper one, and that was hot.
Ooh.
A chili one. In my cabinet at home, I have a lavender, grapefruit, rhubarb, orange, I think lemon. So many. There's so many.
There are. I usually these days just stick with the old classic Angostura.
Oh, yeah, I have one of those too.
Yeah.
Of course, you know.
Yeah. Which is a aromatic one,
mm-hmm.
Yes. There is a company a little bit off the beaten that makes bitters from crickets.
Oh, cool.
It's called Cricket Bitters. The creator started it to help promote crickets and other insects as like a tasty food product and not something gross.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, yeah, their primary flavor ingredient is toasted cricket, which they say brings a sweet, nutty note to drinks. And in speaking to the magazine Popular Science, they once said, "Originally, we had four flavors, but we narrowed down to perfecting one recipe that highlights the cricket element."
The cricket element.
I know.
Oh, I'd try it.
Right?
I would try it.
Absolutely. Oh. In 2015, a paper published in the journal Food Chemistry reported on a study in which the researchers ran 16 commercial brands of bitters through a gas chromatograph to see what they were made of, chemically speaking. And they found that those 16 brands contained a total of 148 flavor compounds, with a mean of 46 compounds in each sample.
That's a lot.
Yeah. The one with the least had 19. The one with the most had 78.
Ooh.
Yeah. The only compound that occurred in all 16 samples was deconal. I'm not sure how to say it, but yes, that thing, it's a sweet floral citrus compound. Yeah.
Hmm.
The concentration of it differed vastly, though, as all the common compounds tended to across the different brands.
Makes sense.
It does.
And I have seen bitters, cocktail bitters, called a bartender's salt and pepper.
Mm-hmm.
Which I like because it's kind of a similar motion as well.
It is, yeah.
And you use it in a similar way.
It's a sprinkle, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But as Lauren alluded to, they kind of started out a bit in a different area,
mm-hmm.
which we will get into. But first, we're going to get into a quick break for a word from our sponsor. Back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So bitters go back a ways. Even if we don't have too much of a historical record of them, what is believed to be the world's first alcoholic mixed drink dates back to 7000 BCE China. And it was
Ooh.
A mixture of grapes, rice, honey, and a bitter, hawthorn berry.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient Greeks would steep bitter herbs in wine for medicinal purposes. But yeah, we didn't get what we consider a bitters today. A bitters? Sure. Yeah, we'll stick
yeah.
with it. until distillation came around, and that really started getting going in like the 1500s and 1600s. In 1690, perhaps the first direct ancestor of cocktail bitters came out. Stoughton's Elixir Magnum Stomachium.
Or Stomachicum. Or it looks like stomach with an ickum at the end.
Yeah. So however, not a word. I think we need to bring it back.
I like it.
Yeah. It meant the great cordial elixir for the stomach.
Mm.
Yes. And this was a patent medicine made from herbs and a bitter gentian root extracted into alcohol. It was either taken straight or mixed into wine or brandy, at first medicinally, but then recreationally sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I found an article when I was researching this that I just thought was super interesting, and a lot of it didn't end up in here, but it was tracing kind of extinct or lost alcohols and bitters, and this was one of them. And apparently you can still find some of these things that are extinct, like on eBay or something like that.
You know, home producers are making them, or
or
perhaps there is some long-lost bottle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, people are trying to recreate a lot of those things, but I that is something I'd never really considered but was super fascinated with.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, all right. So one of the first uses of the word cocktail to mean drink as opposed to a horse's shortened tail was in an agricultural periodical out of Philadelphia published in 1803. 3 years later, in 1806, an early description of a cocktail came with four simple ingredients, quote, a stimulating liquor composed of spirits of any kind, sugar, water, and bitters.
Wow, right there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
This will probably surprise no one, especially because we kind of mentioned it, but bitters started out as more of a medicinal thing. They claimed to cure all kinds of stuff, but mainly things having to do with, yes, indigestion or circulation. One of the first available was called Burdock's Blood Bitters.
Blood Bitters.
Blood Bitters. I'm sure it was it. You put that accent in and it summons a different image than I'm sure is the one that they wanted. But I like it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And if you look at one of the oldest and well-known bitters, the most well-known bitter, Angostura. At first, Angostura was just spices, roots, and barks, and the name came from a city in Venezuela where it was invented, a city that was later renamed. It was invented by a German doctor named Johann Ziegert, working for Simon Bolivar around 1824. He prescribed it, the doctor did, as a stimulant and a malaria preventative. And also, Angostura was a port city. A lot of newly arriving sailors suffered from seasickness.
Yeah.
Since it was a trade town, Angostura spread around the world and eventually achieved worldwide recognition. There are three trees named Angostura, but since the recipe for this bitter is tightly guarded in a vault known only by five employees.
Oh.
Yes. It's hard to say if any of those tree barks were once involved in the bitter. They're not now. We know that. Or that's what the internet tells me. I don't know. Don't send anyone after me. But it is rumored to have over 40 ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny. People assumed that these things were so bitter, they had to be healthy.
Right. Like this tastes so much like poison.
Yes.
That it must be good for you.
Yes. There was no other reason to drink them. Human psychology is fascinating. Gosh. The English had a drink called canary wine that they frequently added bitters to in hopes of adding medicinal value to it. But bitters really took off in colonial America up until Prohibition. It's hard to say whether or not people were drinking bitters straight from the things I read. High-proof infusions made from root, fruit, botanical, or seed-based for their medicinal value. If they were adding them to drinks, if they were just taking shots, maybe they were doing some of both. Probably they were doing some of both.
Probably.
Yes. Another brand name you might recognize got its start in New Orleans in 1838, Peychaud's. Antoine Peychaud got the base of the recipe from his father, who was originally from Haiti. Antoine added his bitters to a brandy toddy. I think we talked about this in our New Orleans cocktails episode very briefly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in 1850, Sazerac Coffee House opened, named after a brand of cognac that no longer exists, and served up a cocktail based on that toddy. And when Filoxera took out a good chunk of French wine and brandy, and that was replaced with rye whiskey, there you go, the Sazerac.
Sazerac cocktail, yep.
Mm-hmm. Prohibition shut down production of Peychaud's, but it restarted after Prohibition's repeal.
And Peychaud's is where the New Orleans style of bitter gets their name because, it's anise-based.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, German bitters brand Underberg got started in 1846. It is still served in these small little bottles to be taken as a shot, and it's imported to the United States as a food product rather than an alcoholic beverage, even though it's like 44% alcohol. We first got it stateside in 1860, and yeah, because it's sold as a food product, it lasted straight through Prohibition.
A couple of them managed to do that. Some mm-hmm. of them didn't have alcohol, but some of them were able to, like, find a loophole, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Jerry Thomas's How to Mix Drinks mentioned bitters in 1862, and bitters were big for Union soldiers during the American Civil War. Entire train cars of Hofstadter's celebrated stomach bitters. This stuff came out of Pennsylvania, and it came with quite the promise. Quote, a positive protective against the fatal maladies of southern swamps and the poisonous tendency of the impure rivers and bayous.
Huh.
Yeah. Union officers dubbed it the soldier's safeguard. It was 94 proof, and once the war ended, it remained popular. As cocktails grew more popular themselves towards the end of the 1800s, bitters became synonymous with cocktails. Even people who didn't drink alcohol might drink bitters for their perceived health benefits. Bitters were also used to improve the taste of cheaper or lower quality alcohol. It helped the medicine go down, as they say. It wasn't uncommon for a bartender to have more than a dozen brands of bitters.
Mm-hmm.
But they ran into some trouble with the U.S. government in the early 19th century when agencies were looking to regulate the outrageous health claims products were making. And bitters made some particularly egregious claims, and this put a dent in the bitters market, and a lot of brands went under.
It was a whole big thing. There was one case in 1905 against Angostura regarding false advertising. They were claiming that their product was medicinal and not intoxicating, and therefore better than competing brands. It's like 40 to 45% alcohol, so anyway. The court said in their verdict, we do not think courts of equity should be swift or vigilant to protect the manufacturers of a compound advertised and sold as a valuable medicine, which is not shown to contain a single medical ingredient or to possess a single merit claimed for it, as against other manufacturers producing and selling a like compound.
Oh.
Which is like a harsh diss in 1905 legalese.
Yeah, I had to absorb that for a minute.
Yeah.
Mm.
But Angostura kept going. Okay, so one of the dudes who testified for Angostura during that court case was one Dr. W.C. Weil, who was then the vice president of the newly forged American Medical Association and a producer of similar products. Nearly 20 years later, Angostura started running ads, all like, the vice president of the American Medical Association testifies to this tonic's value, without mentioning, of course, any of the surrounding circumstances, nor that the testimony had happened 17 years prior.
Oh, of course not.
Of course not. And the Journal of the American Medical Association published a fairly strongly worded smackdown about the ad in 1922 and ended it with, it would be interesting to know just how this product has escaped the eagle eye of the Prohibition Commissioner. Most preparations on the market today containing even less than 45% alcohol have to be doped up with drugs to make their use as beverages impossible.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I like this kind of shade going on and, like, no direct confrontation. So you're fighting it out in, like, articles.
Just on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But Prohibition did not help.
No. And it wasn't until the cocktail revival of the 1990s that bitters started to make a comeback. One brand that managed to survive the dark ages of bitters, the Fee Brothers, which launched in 1950, and they played a role in this comeback of bitters because during the 90s, cocktail buff Ted Haig was looking to make a cocktail named Satan's Whiskers, which called for orange bitters. Haig reached out to one of the only producers in the United States, the Fee Brothers, and he brought a lot of attention to his search and discovery of these bitters. Fee Brothers, though, they use a sugar alcohol base as opposed to ethanol, so some people don't consider them true bitters.
I see. But they do make the product safe for people who otherwise do not consume alcohol.
Yes.
So that's fun.
That is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Still, even as recent as 2002, mixologists were writing about the lack of bitters. They were bemoaning it.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Regan's Bitters entered the market in 2004. He was involved in the cocktail world, and he wrote The Joy of Mixology, and he was determined to make bitters more available. He worked with the Sazerac Company to make Regan's Orange Bitters No. 5. But problem!
Problem?
Too drinkable.
Too drinkable?
Too drinkable.
Not bitter enough.
Not bitter enough. So they went back to the drinking board and came out with Regan's Orange Bitters No. 6. And I just held up a 2, but I guess it was the second try.
Sure. Well, that counts.
Yes. Germany's The Bitter Truth debuted soon after, and then Angostura Orange in 2008.
Yeah, and we had a bitter explosion after that. Around 2009, folks started getting even bolder with their bitters. And Punch magazine points to two New Orleans bartenders for starting the trend when they published a book called Rogue Cocktails, with recipes featuring bitters as a main ingredient, not just a side note. Think like 15 dashes, or a full ounce, or a full 2 ounces of bitters. They were inspired by this recipe that they found by one Charles H. Baker Jr., who was a writer who published a series of books called The Gentleman's Companion in the 1930s and 40s. The recipe that they were so inspired by was for an Angostura sour, which is like 1.5 ounces of bitters mixed with lime juice, sugar, and an egg white.
Huh. I try that too.
I know, right?
I try it too.
Yeah. I've never had a drink that features bitters like that, but now I'm really curious.
I am too. I think I might go home after this and get out my bitters. Mm-hmm. And it is fun because you feel like you're, I'll get out my goggles, be experimenting.
you do feel a little bit mad science-y.
Yeah. And I like feeling a little bit mad science-y.
I never would have guessed that about you.
No. No. It's a hidden part of my personality. I only let it shine every now and then. but this episode, it has inspired me to try some new things with bitters. So that's exciting.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm so excited to have learned that Underberg is a food product that like I could just.
Oh, that's true.
I could just buy like a case of that stuff. Like,
yeah.
Because Georgia has weird shipping laws around alcohol, but
they do, and purchasing it. Although I have noticed that I think you can. I've never tried, but on our Sundays, you're not supposed to buy alcohol before 12:30.
Correct.
But Publix does have some bitters, and they're not in the, like, so what they do is they turn out the lights over that area.
Right.
They put signs up.
Yeah.
But the bitters aren't, the light's still on over them.
Huh.
But they might be, I don't know.
I don't know.
More investigating.
Yeah, yeah. I know that you can't buy, like, cooking sherry.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Nonetheless, research. More research is needed.
Yes, and I can research this on my very own. this brings us to the end of this episode, but we do have a little bit more for you.
We do, but first we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with
Listener Mail. So bitter about life.
We both did the Mr. Burns stapled fingers.
Yes. Yeah, well, you started, and I was just like, oh, this is an important part of the sound.
It is.
It is.
You can hear the steepling of the fingers through the microphone, I'm convinced.
I hope y'all caught that. Yes,
yes. Yes. Only the best for you listeners. Julia wrote, I'm a Starbucks employee, and I work at a mall kiosk. As you listed some stereotypical mall stores like Hot Topic, Spencer's, and Forever 21, I realized that we have every one of those in our mall, as well as a Macy's and a Sears. My mall does, too. I work at that mall. It's basically the most stereotypical Midwestern mall in the country. Part of the fun about working in the mall is having a big work family. A lot of employees at other stores are our regulars, and talking about the customer volume is a popular topic of conversation.
Hmm.
However, shopping malls are extremely creepy. Very creepy. Closing at the mall is pretty unsettling as the lights turn off and me and my coworkers are left alone in the middle of a quiet, empty mall. Our back room, where we keep all of our supplies, is about a 5-minute walk from our kiosk down a long, dark, cursed hallway. Video attached. And she did send the video. She's completely correct. It looks like Silent Hill. I've said it before, I say it again.
100% cursed, yeah.
Yes. Sometimes as I check our stock or grab something from the back, I've heard odd knockings and shrieks from the room next door over the loud buzz of the bare fluorescent lights. Another terrible thing is store meetings. Our kiosk closes at 9:30, and whenever we have our store meetings, we're there in the middle of the big empty mall until midnight sometimes.
Oh, no.
Our meetings are often interrupted by weird sounds and random alarms going off. It's extremely eerie. I don't recommend it. But at the end of the day, it's a pretty fun place to work. And forging alliances with fellow food court employees often earns you free food. A girl who works at Great American Cookies often brings us free cookies, just because.
Aww.
And we also get to people watch during slow times, which is extremely fun. Hope you found my mall stories mildly entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I've always kind of been curious.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who's incredibly creeped out by malls.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. When I watched that video, I was like, mm-hmm, this is what we're talking about. This is it. But it does sound, at least you get free cookies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's a pretty big silver lining.
Yeah. If you got to work in Cursed Place, free cookies.
But there's free cookies.
I might do it, too.
Ascension wrote, I recently finished your MRE episode and wanted to share my MRE tales with you. I didn't serve in the military, but spent 5 summers with the U.S. Forest Service as a wild land firefighter. Our crew was responsible for initial attack for the Powell Ranger District of the Clearwater National Forest. Typically, when a fire was spotted by lookouts or by airplane, 2 or 3 of us would be dispatched to the fire. Because this part of Idaho is really remote, just north of the Selway Bitter Wilderness, we would drive as far as a pickup truck would take us, and then we would hike to the reported location of the fire. Often, it required hiking many miles to reach the reported location. One of the team wore a frame backpack designed to hold a chainsaw. The other wore a regular frame backpack full of water, other essentials, and our food, MREs. To get us used to meals, we would eat a few of them at fire training, also called guard school. The novelty of eating MREs wore off soon if you were working a fire for more than 3 days. This was in the mid-90s, and the meals we would receive at that point didn't come with a heating packet, so we would eat them cold. Peanut butter for crackers was highly desired. Spaghetti with meat sauce hit the spot with everyone, and you would hold on to the tiny bottles of Tabasco hot sauce if you had any left over to try to improve the other meals. For my first 2 seasons, the candy treat packaged with some MREs were M&Ms featuring packaging commemorating the 1984 Olympics.
Ooh.
Yes, I ate them. They seemed okay other than the sugar appearing to separate from the chocolate. There was rumor that the mint gum included in some packages was supposed to be a laxative. I never felt any effects. When we would assemble or reassemble our backpacks, we would try to pack a variety of meals so no pair or trio would end up getting the short end of the stick. Oh, that's so good. However, there was a time when my roommate and squad boss were sent out with a backpack full of the omelet with ham meal, and only omelet with ham. 2 whole days of the same meal. When they returned skunked, Air Patrol had confused a low cloud for smoke. They also wanted to know who the joker was that punished them. No one confessed to putting that particular pack together, but I admire whoever came up with that cruel form of punishment. They must have had a real axe to grind with either my roommate or squad boss. No, it wasn't me. I liked both of those guys. By the time my last season rolled around, 1999, we'd started receiving more current MREs. The packaging had changed from dark brown to a tan color. Heating packets were included and greater varieties were included, even vegetarian options.
Our listeners do the coolest things.
Yeah.
Oh man, I remember once in elementary school, middle school,
mm-hmm.
my mom had a pack of Oreos,
uh-huh.
and it had been in the pantry for many years, and it was long past its expiration date.
Uh-huh.
But I really wanted the Oreos,
of course you did,
and I'm
yeah.
cheap, notoriously, and. All my friends were like, don't do it. It's poison. I don't care. And I took one bite into that Oreo, and it was like the Thanos snap.
It just disintegrated.
Just dissolved into powder. And I've always wondered about what happened to that cookie.
Our coworker, Pam, have found some old trading cards one time. These really cool, weird, like dinosaurs attack trading cards,
uh-huh.
and you know, they came with little packs of sticks of gum, as trading cards frequently did. Do they still? Gosh.
Anyway, I think so. Yeah.
And yeah, the packs still have the gum in them. And I have not eaten a piece of it, but she tells me that some of her friends have, and that they report that it just kind of, yeah, that just sort of disintegrates and sort of puddles.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I'm curious, but not curious enough to ask her for some.
Well, this sounds like another science experiment we could do. It just made me think of it when you mentioned the M&Ms from 1984.
Yeah. Oof.
Anyway.
It's okay. Of all the things to eat a long time after past due, I think chocolate is basically, that's, you know.
But not Oreos.
Not Oreos, no.
Bird from the Rise. Very cool, though. Looked pretty cool. Thanks to both of them for writing in.
Yes.
If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our name is SaverPod at all of those places. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio and Stuff Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to your favorite shows. Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Andrew Howard and Dylan Fagan. Thank you to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.